Hello, I'm Waqar Shah. I'm a Managing Associate at Mishcon de Reuil. In this webinar, we will be discussing litigation and VAT disputes. The first case that I wanted to discuss was the case of the Premier Family Martial Arts in the UK First Tier Tribunal. Now, the bulk of this case relates to the exemption in relation to education, specifically in relation to tuition given privately by teachers. Now, the specific exemption is under Article 1321J of the Principal VAT Directive. Now, as a reminder, that relates to tuition given privately by teachers and covering school or university education. Now, in the past, HMRC have challenged different taxpayers on different elements of that exemption. So there's been some challenges as to whether the subject being taught is in fact tuition, or whether it's something which is purely recreational. There's also been challenges about whether something has been provided privately by a teacher. So for example, the difference between the entity being a partnership or a sole trader as opposed to a limited company. In this case, it didn't so much focus on those elements of the exemption, but focused on the last point, i.e. whether it covers school or university education. Now, the specific topic or subject involved in this case was in relation to kickboxing and, as a broader species, martial arts. Now, there are some facts to be considered and to be kept in mind when considering this one. So there is no governing body for kickboxing, and there are also no formal qualifications. In previous cases, it's been accepted by the tribunals that there doesn't need to be any formal qualifications. The key element is always the test as sort of applied in the ECJ in the Hadera case about the transfer of knowledge and skills. Now, you don't need to transfer knowledge and skills via some sort of qualification in order to achieve that. In this case specifically, regardless of the fact that there wasn't any formal qualifications, there was the weekly lesson plans agreed with the students. There was also homework being set for the students, as well as it being understood that there were certain core elements that were being taught to them. So for example, there was self-discipline, there was the appreciation of what the difference between verbal and non-verbal communication would be, and it was understood that this was having a genuine impact on a lot of what was normally school children and their actual school lives. However, it was also understood that kickboxing itself wasn't on the national curriculum, but martial arts was on the national curriculum. So there are a number of cases for the tribunal to consider. The first one is, well, what is it that the test and what is it that we're looking at? Are we looking at martial arts, or are we looking more precisely at kickboxing? Now, in previous cases, there's been a similar sort of balancing exercise to take place. So just last year, the First Tier Tribunal, holding in favour of the taxpayer in that one, were looking at the case in Anna Cook about Ciroc and the interplay between Ciroc and dance generally. Now, dance is on the syllabus, and I think it's taught in around sort of 95% of schools. Ciroc isn't in and of itself on the syllabus, but in that case, it was understood that there's sufficient overlap between the key elements of both topics. Here, because of supposedly the changing nature of kickboxing compared to the wider martial arts, it wasn't accepted that there was sufficient overlap. Part of it was to do with some of the factual distinctions, i.e. that there's a difference in the number of grapple moves and hold moves and similar such items. It was then moved on to consider, the tribunal then moved on to consider, I should say, whether it was in fact commonly taught. Now, this is the one which would perhaps be of more wider application itself. Now, the taxpayer argued that there shouldn't be any quantitative hurdle on the basis that it would be imposing an unreasonable burden on a taxpayer to establish whether something is commonly taught or not. There's no precise definition given on what's commonly taught, and VAT being a position whereby somebody has to make the decision at their end what they're going to do in terms of their tax liability, should it really be expected that what is often very small or medium-sized companies having to undertake a really unreasonable burden in terms of identifying whether an item is commonly taught. I'll move on to sort of the way in which the tribunal found the conclusion that they weren't within the scope of the exemption, and then look at sort of the wider ramifications of what that might mean, because I think it's particularly unfair here. Now, it was found that, obviously, as mentioned, kickboxing wasn't on the national curriculum, but that this in itself wasn't determinative either way. But there was, as the tribunal phrased it, a rebuttable presumption that it wouldn't be commonly taught if it isn't on the syllabus. So on that basis, they didn't consider that that burden had been overcome. So one of the other elements of it, and one of the ones I mentioned before, was whether it is private education, which was fine, but it was more so in respect of whether it is purely recreational. So it's been accepted in cases in the past that that subjects can be taught commonly, but the actual nature of them is such that they are purely recreational, such that they can't benefit from the exemption. And that's where that test in relation to the transfer of knowledge and skills comes into it. And it was accepted, sort of thankfully here, that despite the lack of qualifications, there was the promotion within the different rankings within kickboxing, there was a progression plan in place, and on that basis, it wasn't purely recreational. I suppose the wider impact, as I mentioned, is for taxpayers to see how prevalent, or more importantly, how commonly something is taught. Now, what was crucial here is the witness evidence that was provided in support of the taxpayer's claim. Now, there are some 35,000 schools in the UK and countless more universities as well. As part of the factual position in this case, what the taxpayer did is they submitted a survey to some 400 providers of martial arts and kickboxing in order to establish and gather as much evidence as possible as to where, when, and how they taught this subject in schools and universities. And the idea being, well, that's the most cost-efficient way, and there couldn't really be a much better way to approach it. Now, although not all 400 replied, a significant amount did. And when you bear in mind that historically, HMRC were happy for something to be considered ordinarily taught or commonly taught if it was taught in just six schools. So there was closer to sort of 20 or so that were provided information and detailed information. But the position taken by the judge and the tribunal in this one was that it wasn't sufficient to overcome the burden of the hurdle, I should say. And the key things that they sort of focused in on was the fact that those who provided answers to the survey didn't appear in person themselves at the tribunal, nor did they provide witness evidence. But if you do look at it sort of holistically, or just take a step back, if you are talking about some 35,000 schools, even if it was 1% of that, so are we really saying that what people should do is inquire as to what 350 schools have done and then get a perspective of it? More importantly, in terms of sort of on the litigation side and always factoring in the sort of the overriding objective, would it really be reasonable for the taxpayer to have filed 350 witness statements, even if it had the funds and the fees able to do so? How long would the hearing be if you did have 350 witnesses there to be cross-examined? Because one of the points the judge made was, oh, it's all very well and good that the providers of these services provided responses to the survey, but there were no sort of comments or letters written by schools. Now, I would imagine schools are busy enough. Now, for the headmaster or headmistress for 300 odd schools to write in request to surveys or similar letters from taxpayers in the future to say, oh, I'm looking to set up a school which is teaching just this subject, can you tell me if this is taught in your school? That'll be a non-stop element to their day job, which is already, I'm sure, busy enough. So I think there is a difference between obviously understanding that something's an exemption from VAT and therefore must be clearly make sure that the scope of it is not widened too much, completely understood, but there's a difference between that and setting unnecessarily or sort of absurdly high burdens. And one of the points that the taxpayer's counsel made in this case was that you're also sort of considering or not sort of factoring the sort of fiscal drag, because there is going to be some subjects which aren't taught as widely in schools and universities now, but maybe in the future. So why should it be the case that they'd have to wait a few years for it to be in that position? Now, the example which wasn't mentioned in the tribunal, but one that sort of comes to mind, is something like coding, or something which is very a very modern thing, some people may say. It might not be in schools or universities now, but it's a skill that even the government are saying it's a very useful one to have. So that's the key parts of that case. In terms of what the tribunal found. So unfortunately, the taxpayer didn't fall within the exemption itself, but the comments in respect of evidence and what would be needed to overcome the burden in particular might be of more use, not just for those trying to use this exemption, but exemptions generally, and particularly when one factors in the point that this isn't a very large taxpayer at all. This is a fairly small business, and to impose this sort of test or hurdle upon them is particularly, or for want of a better phrase, unfair. And with any hope there'll be some future tribunal decision which sort of address the position further, as unfortunately I don't think this case is going to be appealed.
That's interesting. If I might jump in with a question there, Michael. It strikes me as very interesting the subject matter of these cases. So you touched on the fact that these tend to be quite small providers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also that the assessment they have to make is very fact sensitive. In fact, the assessment the tribunal has to make is very fact sensitive. But it interests me, for example, that if you think about how cuts to school funding is impacting, a lot of the time we see some of the elements of the curriculum that are perhaps regarded as dispensable being got rid of just as a matter of budgeting and funding. And so lots of things are now being taken out of the formal curriculum and end up sometimes as extracurricular activities. And of course we have that whole range of things that people do alongside their normal lives, perhaps as, let's say, tango lessons or something of that variety. So do you think this is an area where you're expecting to see more challenges? Do you think there's going to be a broader range of topics than just this one?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already acted on a few in particular. So I mentioned the dance and Siroc one, and I've mentioned this case as well. But absolutely, this is something that's affecting a lot of people just because of HMRC's change of tact. As I say, if they previously accepted just being taught in six schools was enough, but have overnight changed that position and not even suggested what they would accept, it's going to be a position where unfortunately, people are going to have to challenge it to get to that point. Now, one of the points that we've discussed about with clients is, and it's sort of a quirk of the system, if you like, is there might be subjects which may not be ordinarily taught in schools across the country, but in certain schools they are. So in private schools, there might be some subjects which are taught, but just because it's only in private schools, of which there are not as many as state schools, does that make a difference? The fact that, for example, Latin may be taught in some schools, which is a small percentage of the wider population, does that mean it's not commonly taught? There was even discussions about certain sports which are only perhaps taught in some types of schools. Sailing was one of them, and similar ones such as that. But absolutely, it looks like an area where, unfortunately, it doesn't affect many big players, but it's very much those at the lower end of the scale in terms of size who are getting hit and overnight having to charge much more, obviously, for their services, particularly if they're in competition with others when, as we know, times are particularly hard. So it does make a difference on a day-to-day basis. So disappointing decision.
Absolutely. And I've certainly acted for some where, you know, the circumstances feel very unfair, actually, because the size of the entity means that they're looking at quite substantial liabilities unexpectedly and have had to make actually quite a difficult decision about how they deal with things
Absolutely.
From that perspective.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Pass over to you.
So let's move on to a slightly different case. This is NCP and HMRC. This was a Court of Appeal decision in May of last year, and it's to do with that very familiar situation of being in a pay and display car park where the machine doesn't give you correct change, and so when you go to pay the amount that you have to pay, you put in your money and you don't get any change back. And the question that the court was asked to address is whether the amount that you pay, which is excess over the tariff, is subject to VAT. So NCP, as you'll no doubt know, operate, amongst other things, pay and display car parks. There's normally a board which specifies the tariff per the amount of time spent, and normally you buy your ticket in advance. When you do that, you estimate how much time you're going to be in the car park, and you get a ticket printed with the end time, the duration that you're going to be there, and typically the ticket will be given in, say, hour-long increments. You display your ticket in the car. The machine in this example does not normally give you change, and it states that overpayments are accepted. So let's take a sort of a standard example as the court looked at it. So let's say, for example, that the price for an hour's parking is £1.40. You'd go to the machine and you've only got a pound coin and a 50p coin. So as you would, you pop both of those in and you press the green button to get your ticket. And what you're given is a ticket for an hour. You don't therefore get any extra time for the extra 10p that you've spent. But of course, it is also possible to leave without paying if you decide you don't want to pay overpay the extra 10p. So in this case, NCP made a claim in 2014 to recover the sums for which it had accounted to HMRC as VAT in respect of the overpayments. And HMRC refused on the basis that the overpayment amounts should be regarded as consideration for the right to park, and therefore that's taxable. NCP appealed, and the basis of the appeal was that the payments are ex gratia and therefore they are outside the scope of VAT. And we've had a sort of fairly mixed run through the tribunals. So in the first tier tribunal, they dismissed NCP's appeal. The upper tribunal, unfortunately, agreed with the FTT, and then the Court of Appeal dismissed NCP unanimously. I'll talk very briefly about the law on this, and actually this is going to impact on one of the cases I'm dealing with later on. So Article 1.2 of the Principal VAT Directive provides for the application to goods and services of a general tax on consumption exactly proportional to the price of the goods and services. Article 2.1c provides that transactions are subject to VAT where they are for the supply of services for consideration. And Article 73 deals with the taxable amount, and it says that the taxable amount includes everything which constitutes consideration obtained or to be obtained by the supplier in return for the supply from the customer or a third party. And those provisions are all replicated in the VAT Act 1994. So one of the crucial issues in this case, and in Marks and Spencer, which we're going to discuss later, is what does consideration mean? Mm. So in this context, it's very important that it's not the domestic law context, domestic law definition, rather, which is important. It makes sense if you think about it, because given that it's derived from a directive, it has to be the autonomous EU-wide meaning, not the domestic one, which might vary according to member state. So it's not the domestic contract law meaning, it is an autonomous EU-wide meaning. And the case deals in some detail with what that meaning might be. One of the cases it deals with is the Dutch potato case, and there are a few others, but the key issues that they come up with are that services for consideration presuppose a direct link between the services provided and the consideration received. They also talk about there being a need for a legal relationship between the provider of the service and the recipient of the service. There must be reciprocal performance, and the remuneration received by the provider has to constitute the value of the service actually given in return for the service actually supplied to the recipient. So essentially, the nature of the consideration that we're dealing with is the value that's actually received. There's also a very interesting case which comes up quite often in this context called Tolsma, to do with a busker and how the contributions he receives should be treated for VAT purposes. And so in that case, an ECJ case, they said, well, there isn't any agreement between the parties. There isn't any necessary link between music, the music that's performed, and the payment. Necessary is an interesting word there, because of course it's an odd word and it's quite hard to interpret it, but we'll take it as it is. And then, of course, they say that the sums, this is very interesting, the sums that the busker receives don't depend on the musical service because there are other factors which might come into play. For example, sympathy might be one of the reasons that you give money to a busker. I think that probably assumes he's not very good, but that's by the by. But the point actually in Tolsmer is that these are voluntary payments rather than contractual ones. And they also highlight the uncertainty of the nature of those payments as well. So the court looked at all of these different factors, and the upper tribunal held that £1.50 is the amount of consideration, not £1.40. NCP argued that the direct link criterion has a quantitative aspect as well as a causal one. So when you're looking at that extra 10p, that is important in relation to whether or not it's consideration. And they also argue that it's there is only consideration if there is a direct link to the supply. HMRC argued exactly the same as they've done all the way through, as far as I could see, which is that contractual price for parking was £1.50. There was a direct link. The supply was for an hour for which the person would pay £1.50. I think quite rightly NCP accepted that if £1.50 was the consideration from a contractual point of view, then that would mean that their claim would not succeed.
Absolutely.
I think that was a proper concession to make. And so the analysis was essentially around whether the consideration was £1.40 or £1.50. And the finding was that, you know, the conclusion of the contract is when the green button is pressed. And so even though NCP argued that the 10p extra couldn't be called an overpayment if it was part of the price, the court sort of dispensed with that. They said English law takes a very objective approach to these types of situations. The offer from NCP was characterised in an interesting way, differently to how the Upper Tribunal characterised it. They said that the offer from NCP was for an hour's parking for coins worth at least £1.40. Mm. Whereas the upper tribunal, the previous court rather, had characterised it as between £1.40 and £2.09, because the next level up was
£2.10.
Yeah. So it's very specifically an hour's parking for coins worth at least £1.40. The pressing of the green button constitutes acceptance of the contract for a 1 hour value for the coins that have been put into the machine. And they noted that there isn't any right of repayment for the overpayment. They also added an interesting coda, if you like, at the end of this decision, which is that the local authority car parks, of which there are obviously very many, have a slightly different situation. So local authority car park tariffs are set by a bylaw, and so they're in a different, they're not strictly speaking in a contractual position. There was a first tier tribunal decision in which they said that overpayments in that context were not consideration. And the court noted in its way they weren't going to give a final view, but they would not want to be seen to be endorsing that decision. So it seems to me that there's a potential for further dispute in this area, particularly in relation to local authority car parks, because they seem to be in a slightly awkward position in the sense that they've got a first-tier tribunal decision which says one thing and the Court of Appeal clearly doesn't want to endorse it at the very least. So I think that does create quite a lot of uncertainty from their perspective. Marcus, do you have any thoughts on this case?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting one. I mean, I think at one of the earlier levels, one of HMRC's arguments was that the additional 10 pence that might be paid was for the use value, if you like. So it was this point about you've always got the opportunity to leave the car park if you think, I don't want to pay more than £1.40, I don't care if it's just 10p. And it was the sort of avoiding the additional burden of having to leave the car park and go find somewhere with correct change or going somewhere else which would take £1.50 and give you change as well. So,
or trying to get change from somebody else in the car park.
But coming back in. So you're sort of paying an additional 10p to avoid that burden because you can just park your car, leave it, place it in the window screen and be on your way. They dropped that argument, I think, somewhere along the way. It may have been after the first tier or possibly the upper tribunal decision. But I still think, I still have trouble with the decision overall because it's almost sort of forgiving customers for the bad bargain that they're making, it's quite clear that the price, as stated, regardless of what the Court of Appeal consider, that, oh, in effect, you're paying for at least 1 hour's parking for between £1.40 and up to £2.09. But that isn't what the contract says. That isn't what the board say in the car park. They say £1.40 for 1 hour and £2.10, I think, for two or 3 hours.
Yeah.
So it's quite clear. There is no range, and the overpayment's being accepted. It's your choice. You don't have to park there. It's not as if once you're in and, well, you're a bit stuck now. There's other car parks. There's local authority car parks, or go and find some change. So I don't know specifically. I don't know about the application or the overlap between this and Tollsmoor, for example. But nonetheless, given that it is obviously the Court of Appeal, it is binding on others. I suppose it has less of an application in what going forward, because there's more and more card payment type machines in car parks and everywhere else, or apps. So the extent to which this is going to have a real impact generally perhaps is limited, but an interesting one.
Sure. I did wonder, actually, thinking about that question of whether this is going to continue to be an issue because of, you know, some people using cash, some people choosing to use apps. I did wonder that obviously there are some areas where people have less access to cards and apps, etc. And I wonder actually if this might end up with a sort of a general level of unfairness, that in some of those areas, particularly where cash is more important, people might end up overpaying in some circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good point. Yeah, so taxing people even more, if you like, or charging them even more because of the position that they're in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. I shall hand back to you.
Fantastic. Thank you. So I'm going to move on to the decision of the Upper Tribunal, released just before Christmas, and which turned out to be a very welcome, I'm sure, early Christmas present for the owners of some big media companies, in particular at question here, The Times, The Sunday Times, The Sun, and The Sun on Sunday. And this was the decision in News Corp UK and Ireland Limited and HMRC. Now, this was an appeal in respect of a decision of the first tier tribunal in relation to digital versions of newspapers and whether or not they're in item 2, group 3, Schedule 8 of the VAT Act 1994. Now, the case being that if they were within that definition, they would be zero rated. Now, I think it's worth giving some sort of context as to some of the key arguments that were in discussion here, because as well as the key VAT technical elements to it, there's also discussions in relation to certain doctrines that were in play, one of which I'll go on to explain, is the always speaking doctrine. Now, Article 110 of the Principal VAT Directive relates to the preservation, if you like, of measures for zero rating enacted immediately prior to the UK joining the European Union. Now, it's worth keeping that in mind. Now, the facts of this case related to different sort of digital versions. So there were ones on e-readers, there were ones on tablets, and also the website versions. Now, it was understood and considered at the first tier that the e-reader and the tablet version, for example, were almost exactly the same as those in print. And that's completely understandable. If you picked up a print version of a newspaper and went online, you wouldn't expect to see completely different content from the same newspaper. The website was updated a bit more frequently. And before, I think it was 2016, it was in a sort of more of an ongoing position. But after 2016, it was updated three times a day at fixed intervals. And that's a really important point here. It wasn't normally when there was some new breaking news. Now, it was common ground between the parties that an essential characteristic of newspapers is that it is produced in periodic editions, rather than the rolling news. Now, what they mean by rolling news is some of the other websites which are continually updated. So, for example, The Guardian's website is a good source for that, or BBC News, which has always got some form of breaking news. Now, it was also understood, and as we've just sort of discussed and touched upon, the content of the digital versions and the print papers, in this case, for this supplier were fundamentally similar. No huge surprise there. And even if you look at it from the consumer's perspective, who's picking up the paper or going online, the real crux of what they're after is the content, not the sort of medium, which is important. So it didn't matter, for example, that obviously on the online versions you might get some additional bells and whistles. So if you're reading a story, it might also have a short video online adding to it, or some sort of animation which may help with it. It didn't really make much of a difference to the actual content itself. Now, at the first tier tribunal, quite shockingly, or some may say, they actually considered Group 3 generally, mm-hmm. and their position, as they understood it, was Group 3 just didn't apply to services at all. So therefore, as it was agreed between the parties that the digital version was a service, it couldn't fall within the exemption. Now, I think it's not too much of a giveaway to say the upper tribunal didn't exactly endorse that view, which I'll go on to shortly. But the other element of what the first tier tribunal looked at is that zero rating is a derogation from the general principle. Understood, I don't think anyone's going to contest that point. And therefore, from the first tier tribunal's position, it should be construed strictly, and therefore the always speaking doctrine, which I'll go on to, doesn't apply. So that was the first tier tribunal's decision, which meant it was a loss for the News Corp. Now, just some explanation of what the always speaking doctrine is, because it's not something that would necessarily come up a lot in VAT or indirect tax matters. Now, what this is about is the construction, which takes account of relevant changes that perhaps weren't there at the time a law was put in place, but something which doesn't alter the meaning of the wording. So it's a presumption that Parliament intends the court to apply to an act a construction that continuously updates its wording to allow for changes. And the court's role, or one of them, is to give effect to Parliament's intention or Parliament's purpose. Now, it's quite clear and is understood that Parliament's purpose in regard of zero rating of the newspapers was to promote literacy, it was to disseminate knowledge, and have sort of democratic accountability by having an informed public debate based on various news items. And it's obviously understood that zero rating is an exception to the general rule. But in the Supreme Court, in the SAE case, which is one we're going mm-hmm. to talk about soon,
yep.
It was clarified that the principles must be construed in a manner which is consistent with objectives which underpin them. And that is an absolutely crucial point here. There was no, and this was quite an important one, there was no statutory provision which specifically excluded digital newspapers from zero rating. So therefore, the real question here was, can the term newspapers be considered to, or construed to, include digital newspapers? And that's when they went into sort of the body of case law surrounding whether something is within the same genus of facts as they formulated it. So even if it was a case that an item didn't fall in the zero rate in 1991, that's not determinative at all, because it could just be that the item didn't exist in 1991, understood. Mm-hmm. And if it did, if that is the case, it would have been zero rated because, as I say, it falls within the same genus of facts. And even if you go to other cases which didn't necessarily touch upon the always speaking doctrine, even in terms of technological advances, there was the case a few years ago now involving Harrier in respect of extending the zero rate of books to photo books.
Yes.
And in that case, Judge Berner in the First Tier Tribunal talked about how, well, this is exactly why sort of the always speaking doctrine is there. It's to take into factor the technological advances. Now, in that case, they didn't look at the always speaking doctrine, but the point was clear. Technological advances must always be factored in by the law. And so on that basis, it would be within the scope of the zero rate. They also, as I've touched upon, they also overturned the decision that Group 3 only applies for goods, because the point was, even if when enacted, all of the elements of Group 3 were goods at the time or met the legal test for goods, that's not determinative at all. it didn't really make a difference that these were services, they still met the relevant elements of the test. So that's quite a useful one. Now, there were some very similar characteristics between the paper and the digital copy. As we said, the content was fundamentally similar, and the updates to the digital version were fairly minor. So therefore, that also wasn't considered, as I say, rolling news, which was, as I say, one of the key points, because if it was, it would be taking it away from the periodic edition updates. And it was clarified that and understood that although zero rating is obviously an exception to the general rule and therefore does require strict interpretation, so far so good, this isn't the same as saying that a provision was included or sort of intended, I should say, to be restricted or circumscribed. So that's the sort of key point here. They were taking, HMRC evidently were taking a far too narrow view, as were the first tier tribunal in this case. The question for others is to what extent this could be applied to other such matters, not just newspapers, and whether other entities could also make claims on the back of this case. It wouldn't obviously be a massive surprise if this does make its way to the Courts of Appeal. I imagine at some point at the very end of this year or early next year, so one to keep an eye out for.
It's interesting, of course, because you know, the way we consume our news changes quite a lot, doesn't it? Especially in terms of development of apps or different ways of reading. So do you think in future, news organisations will have to consider this case and this sort of factual matrix quite carefully when they're assessing how they produce and deploy, I guess, their
news? Yeah, absolutely. I think, obviously, the VAT position is perhaps not the top of the list when it comes to newspaper companies, or pretty much any company, when it comes to setting up their sort of business or expanding or anything like that. But here it's obviously such a massive difference, so one that needs to be top of the agenda or the headline, if I say so, or for those to factor in, and for others to see, are there any elements here that could be widely applied such that they could be in a better position from that perspective as well.
Absolutely. So in further things that we consume relatively often, M&S, this is that very popular and well-known dine-in for two for £10 offer. And this is the one which concerned free wine. So this is, you're probably familiar with the overall structure of it, but in essence, the general offer is that you get three food dishes for payment of £10, plus a free bottle of wine or a non-alcoholic beverage instead. The issue is around whether the food items are sold separately to the wine. Essentially, food items sold separately are going to be zero rated, wine will be standard rated. And so the question that was before the upper tribunal here was whether the £10 should be apportioned between the food and the wine items, or whether the wine should be free for VAT purposes. The FTT had decided that the £10 should be apportioned, and M&S appealed to the upper tribunal, and the upper tribunal dismissed that appeal. As I said, the deal is three specified items, so normally main course, side and dessert. And what was being offered in this case was those three plus free wine. There are some interesting details around how this offer works. So this specific offer was for limited periods. And the terms and conditions were not, in fact, detailed very thoroughly in the store, but they were available online. And they said that the value of the wine is zero. And if, for example, you wanted to return the wine, you wouldn't get a refund. Although if you did want to return, say, some of the food, you might, you would get your refund. It's interesting also to think about the receipt and how that worked. So the receipt set out the full prices of each of the food items, and then they set out a deduction in relation to those food items so that the pricing would be appropriate for the offer. And then they showed the wine on the receipt as well, but that was shown as free. And then the final line added it all up and concluded items four, balance £10.
Right.
So The FTT, when thinking about this, they found as a fact that if a customer returned any food item, they would get the full £10 refund, but returning wine, no refund. They therefore said that the wine was offered conditionally. And they said that there was a single offer for four items and it was all the same transaction, but that the free wine was conditional on payment of that £10. And therefore, on that basis, they thought it was appropriate to allocate that £10 across the items. And I should note that it was agreed between the parties that they were happy with how the allocation was to be made. So the tribunal was not asked to deal with exactly the right details of that allocation. The tribunal also looked at what the economic reality was, and they said that you couldn't get the wine for no consideration. So, you know, you can't turn up in the shop and ask for the bottle of wine without spending your £10. So that was the economic reality of the case. On appeal to the upper tribunal, this case, because it's to do with consideration, referred to all of the same cases that we've referred to in NCP. So they talked about the Dutch potato case, they talked about the cases on direct links, they referred to Tolsma and the busking, and they referred to NCP as well. Essentially the arguments in the FTT and the upper tribunal were very similar. So HMRC argued that there was just a single transaction, there were three separate zero-rated food supplies and one separate rated wine supply, but they were all for consideration. There was a direct link and there was a causal relationship between the £10 and the four items, so including the wine. They also submitted that the label that was applied of the wine being free was irrelevant, not dissimilar to the wording overpayment being irrelevant,
yeah, absolutely,
in NCP. M&S said that, you know, no part of the £10 was consideration for the wine, and they relied on the terms of the agreement, the signs which were placed around where the food was, the till receipts. And then they also said that you could still get the three items of food for £10 without the bottle of wine. So you didn't have to take the bottle of wine or indeed the non-alcoholic beverage. They also relied on the fact that there was no reciprocal performance with the wine, so you couldn't get a refund for the wine. Mm-hmm. And they said that ultimately the fact in particular that you could buy three items of food, they would normally be worth more than £10, but you get them for £10, that reflects economic reality. In this case, the upper tribunal essentially just went with HMRC. So £10 was regarded as consideration for both food and wine. There was a direct link between the £10 and the wine because you couldn't get the wine without the £10 payment. They linked the commercial reality point to this idea that you would only use the word free in this context in a marketing sense or a promotional sense. So the fact that M&S had described it as free wine was just, I suppose, marketing puff, if I can put it that way. I suppose it's worth noting that this is, in a sense, the flip side of the NCP case on consideration. So it's one where we seem to be getting quite a lot of case law at the moment. It wouldn't surprise me if this case went a bit further. It seems to be an important point.
It's definitely an interesting one, and I thought what was one of the important elements to this is the way Marks and Spencer's explained it is, it wasn't the case that, for example, if someone did come into the store and say, oh, I'll just have that free bottle of wine, they could just do that. It was absolutely linked to the rest of the transaction. Now, so I understand completely the way in which Marks and Spencer's wanted this to be viewed, but I think you said it was sort of marketing puff. I mean, it's the same to an extent as those car hire or car finance deals or anything like that, where they say, we'll pay your VAT for you. It doesn't quite work like that in practice. So an interesting one. Whether it goes to the Courts of Appeal, who knows? But yeah, as ever, another one to keep an eye on.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I'll just move on to the next case. So this is in respect of the Good Law Project, in which Uber was an interested party for reasons which I'll come on to are quite obvious. Now, the Good Law Project is a sort of crowd-funded organisation that supposedly, according to their own sort of website, they bring strategic legal cases in relation, I think, primarily to tax law,
mm-hmm.
As concerning how the law works, with a drive or demand for further reform as necessary. Now, the background to this one was in relation to an infamous taxi ride undertaken by a barrister in London, at the end of which he asked for a sort of VAT receipt mm-hmm. or invoice, which wasn't provided by the driver because Uber says that it itself isn't VAT registered, because the drivers are self-employed, and therefore the only way he would get some sort of VAT receipt or invoice would be if the drivers had registered for tax, if they're over the threshold, or decided to do so themselves, which unsurprisingly not many did. And the position adopted by Uber was that they therefore didn't need to charge VAT, and therefore as a corollary, none was accounted to HMRC. Now, there are sort of various cases on the back of that in respect of whether that's the correct position. And what the GLP did here is issue a judicial review mm-hmm. against HMRC's supposed failure to raise protective assessments against Uber. And that's because Uber is either liable to account for VAT or that there's a risk of underpaid VAT. So rather than HMRC being in the position whereby they fall outside of time and can say, well, our hands are tied, we can't do anything about it, the GLP wanted them to be in a position whereby if the position is clarified and they should have had the VAT, they are able to get it. Now, as part of that proceedings, HMRC made an application under Section 18 of the Commissioners for Revenue and Customs Act 2005, known as CRACA. Known by some as CRACA anyway. So Section 18 of CRACA relates to confidentiality.
Yeah.
And this is obviously a fairly hot topic and has been for at least a decade or so. This is particularly in relation to how HMRC use the information that they get from taxpayers. And Section 18 refers to the fact that they shouldn't and may not disclose information unless under subsection C, which was the main element in issue here, it's for the purpose of civil proceedings. Now, HMRC were worried about Section 19 of CRACA, which says it's an offence to disclose information unless the disclosure was lawful. So essentially they wanted some sort of order from the court to say, yes, you can release the information. Now, the High Court here considered cases including the Fleet Street Casuals case.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, there were discussions about the total confidentiality of assessments between the revenue and individuals being a vital element of the system, which one can debate whether that's as vital as it may have seemed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they went as far to say one taxpayer has no sufficient interest in asking the court to investigate the affairs of another and or to complain about underassessment. So quite damning in that respect about the actual power that you have in this sort of area. They also considered the more recent case of Ingenious in the Supreme Court. And in that one, it was a senior HMRC official who provided an off-the-record briefing to various elements of the media with regards to the claimant's tax affairs, to put it lightly. And in that case, it was clarified that HMRC's ability to receive and hold confidential information about financial affairs is for the purpose of enabling it to assess and collect what's properly due. And the overall balance here, as can be justified, is between the importance of open justice, i.e. knowing who's paid tax and whatever, but maintaining taxpayer confidentiality. Now, in this case, as the interested party, Uber argued that their right of confidentiality is obviously crucial here, and that the only way that the court should make such an order, allowing HMRC to release the information, is if the court was satisfied that it's necessary in order for HMRC to defend the separate challenge. High Court slapped that down straight away, because otherwise they'd be introducing a test of necessity into the legislation, and there's no intention from Parliament that that's what was intended at all. So another case about parliamentary intention here. Now, one of the other key elements of this case is HMRC being sort of told by the High Court that they should have made this decision themselves, because what's quite clear from the legislation in hand, under Cracker, I should say, is the decision of whether to release it for civil proceedings is under subsection 18.2c. And if it was the case that the court was to decide it, it would almost make OTIOS the subsection 18.2e, because that relates to allowing the provision of data by court order. So if supposedly civil proceedings under 2c means that the court have to decide, then what would be the point of having 18.2e, which means it's by court order? So it's absolutely an HMRC to make the decision as to what the position is. Now, in terms of HMRC's fear that they may sort of breach anything under Section 18 or Section 19, the High Court sort of suggested that what they could do is make it clear to the likes of Uber that information has been requested and notify them of them. How that works in practice and what would happen if, in a sort of counterfactual sense, that had happened here and Uber sort of refused that, what would happen? Would it go to a separate tribunal? Who would be the one challenging? Would it be Uber? Would it be the initial person? Would it be HMRC? Quite a few things to consider there. But the overarching point was also the fact that the supposed intrusion into Uber's Article 8 confidentiality rights was supposedly only slight, such that they decided it was lawful to disclose the information in the civil proceedings. So not the most VAT technical one, but particularly given that it relates to taxpayer confidentiality and litigation, one which I thought would be more relevant for this webinar than others.
It's a very interesting one. I mean, I see in the context of other JRs in other areas than tax, the use of confidentiality ring orders quite often. So particularly where you've got, say, for example, a procurement or an exercise whereby somebody's applying for some funding and you've got a number of people who win or don't, as the case may be. And you often have, in those circumstances, a challenger will want to see, you know, the context of the marking, or they'll want to see a bit more about the commercial information in that deal or whatever. And it's very common to establish a confidentiality ring, and that will normally be subject to the consent of whoever's information is being passed over. And when I first saw this case, I did wonder why something of that type wasn't considered. But I suppose it's because there is some specific legislative provision which needed to be dealt with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it looks like. But from the sounds of it, this is going to be one of perhaps quite a few cases that Uber are going to be involved in, not just on the indirect tax side over the perhaps next few years.
Yeah, so, indeed. Okay, so moving on to a slightly different topic. This is an education one. So this is a case that went up to the Supreme Court last year. And I mean, as you'll know, supplies of education are exempt if they're made by a college or university, which you'll find in Note 1B of Item 1, Group 6 of the VAT Act 1994. In this case, the question really was whether an undertaking was a college, and the particular entity here, SEL, argued that they were a college of Middlesex University. In terms of how this has progressed, the first-tier tribunal allowed the appeal of the taxpayer, the upper tribunal allowed the revenues appeal, Court of Appeal then dismissed the taxpayer's appeal, and then the Supreme Court unanimously allowed the taxpayer's appeal. In terms of what this dealt with, this was the School of Audio Engineering, who were essentially functioning as a technical college, and they had a memorandum of understanding to teach a Bachelor of Arts in Recording and Multimedia Arts, as well as some other subjects of that type along a period of a few years. And it was said that they were providing a validated collaborative programme with University of Middlesex, and they were formerly an associate college of Middlesex University. So, as I say, the question that came to the court was whether or not that undertaking and what it provided was a college. It's quite an interesting case because it's probably a really quite broad commercial application, given that SEL was operating in a sense quite separately from the university. Here, the Supreme Court said that the exemption did apply, and they looked at what's quite a disparate set of case law and then said, well, these are the key exemptions and key factors for the exemption, rather. So in the first place, they looked at how you fit within the definition. And they said, well, the entity must provide education. Okay. But it also noted that the exemption only worked if what was being provided was by a body governed by public law or something similar. And also, interestingly, they said that there is nothing in the legislation which requires that the entity has to have a constitutional or structural element like a college. So it doesn't have to be, you know, a building around a forecourt or whatever. It doesn't have to be something of that variety. It just has to have these key elements. And also, they said that the UK, on a sort of general basis, has to be assumed to take it that a college does have the same aims as the university. So a college of the university has the same aims as the university itself. And then they looked a little bit more about whether something is a college, and they identified some further factors. So there must be a common understanding between the college and the university that it is operating as a college of the university. They also thought it was very important that the college could enrol or matriculate students, and also that students of that entity are treated as university students or students of the university. And then also, of course, that the courses that are going to be provided are approved courses by the university. And then finally, that the entity can present its students for graduation. So an interesting one. It seems to me that these factors are going to be a pretty wide application, as I say, to a range of different entities. Because, of course, the tricky bit is the point about it not being a structural or constitutional college. You've got to work your way through these factors. I think this type of taxpayer is in a different position to, say, our tango dancers or our syrup dancers, who perhaps have slightly less resource at hand to work out the answer to this question. But I can see that this might add a little uncertainty rather than help, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, and I mean, I thought when I read this case, as you say, last year, the fact that there was this sort of sufficient, I know their words weren't used, but there was this element of control. The fact that the courses provided did need to be approved as such. The college couldn't go off on a whim and introduce courses that the university didn't approve. I thought that would be more determinative than it ended up being. But as I say, it's not as if it could go any further now, because it's all the way up in the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
But that's the position that they're in.
Indeed. And now there's, of course, the Revenue and Customs Brief, which sets out a little bit more guidance on that, as useful as they usually are.
Indeed, I'm sure.
Great.
Fantastic.
Okay. I shall hand back.
So I'll move on to my final case, which isn't a particularly short one, and not one I was going to spend very much time on at all. It particularly piqued my interest mainly because of the wider application of sort of village halls and that sort of stuff, but also because it's not particularly often that one's work combines with their first love. So cricket and VAT. You can work out which one's the one I do on a daily basis, which one I actually love. So this one was about a village cricket club registered as a community amateur sports club, or a CASC for short. So what happened in this case is that the pavilion itself of the CASC was destroyed by a fire, and a contractor was engaged to build a new one. And they assumed that they should benefit from zero rating again, but this under Schedule 8 Group 5. Now, the key to benefit from the zero rating was that the pavilion had to be used for a relevant charitable purpose. Now, it was understood that the club was established for a charitable purpose in accordance with Schedule 6 of the Financial FA to 2010. But there's a disagreement as to the effect of the Section 6 of the Charities Act 2011 definition. Now, just as a reminder, because it might not be at the top of everyone's list for VAT practitioners, the Section 6 Charities Act 2011 definition is a registered sports club established for charitable purposes, which is to be treated as not being so established and therefore cannot be a charity. So it was a case of sort of statutory interpretation, and the Upper Tribunal considered that the purpose of Schedule 6 of the Financial FA 2010 was to provide a new definition of charity for tax purposes, but that's distinct from the definition of charity for charity law generally. So the closest I can think of is in employment law. Mm-hmm. There's different understanding of what workers might be for tax purposes or employment law purposes, or employed and self-employed in the difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the upper tribunal in this case considered it was that there was not the slightest indication from Parliament or anywhere else that the Schedule 6 definition was aimed at the position that a sports club could be registered as a CASC but benefit from the tax relief of a charity. And the real reason behind that sort of stuff is charities obviously have the benefits of exemptions and the like, but they have quite a lot of regulation to deal with, and they have to open themselves up for a lot of inspection on that basis. So you can't quite broadly avoid all the regulations of the charity sides, but get all of the benefits. Or, as I think someone described it, not in the hearing itself, but you can't have your charity cake and eat it as a cask, if you like. So the position is clear for sports club on the mm-hmm. back of this, which is you can register as a cask or you can register as a charity, but not as both. So it was held that the pavilion was not used for a charitable purpose. One of the sort of wider points was, even in terms of what they did factually, the pavilion could be hired for private functions on days that cricket wasn't being played. So HMRC were successfully able to argue that that meant the pavilion fell outside of the exemption. The wider importance is whether the pavilion was used as a village hall, and that's more applicable to quite a lot of entities across the sort of UK. And the key point from the tribunal in this case was that the discussion that if the club was established for a purpose of providing sporting facility for members or of a local community, they don't see the use by the members of the club ceases to be community use. So some interesting points there, one to delve into a bit more for those this may potentially affect. What was interesting is, despite arguments in relation to sort of fiscal neutrality and that perhaps there might be a breach there or the lack of equal treatment, the upper tribunal said that that doesn't apply here at all, actually, because you're treating two different entities altogether, and a body which sort of is considered to be a charity and one that isn't don't need to be compared on the same basis, so therefore the fiscal neutrality element doesn't bite at all. So unfortunately not a great outcome for this little cricket club. Again, another example of clarifying the VAT position before you steam ahead and undertake all this work. And I mean, given the amount at stake and the size of this entity, a query as to whether this is going to be taken any further, but there we are.
Indeed, something of a theme of small taxpayers having a bit of a bashing today.
Seems to be the case perhaps not for the foreseeable future, but one would hope, but who knows.
Well, on that note, I'm going to take us to a slightly cheerier case for the taxpayer. This one involves cars, and like, as you know, that is something of an interest of
Absolutely.
Mine too. So this is a customs case. I'll be very brief on it. It's not a very complicated case. It was to do with a customs civil evasion penalty under Section 25(1) of Finance Act 2003. And essentially, Autokit, the taxpayer here, they were a wholesaler of car parts and accessories, particularly fabric and leather seat covers, which they were importing from outside of the EU. The Revenue visited them and said that the imports that they were doing were being done under the incorrect codes, and so there'd been an underpayment. And they told Autokit that they should inform the suppliers that they were all being filed on the wrong codes. They also wrote to Autokit and said that in circumstances where Autokit was supplying fabric for free to the manufacturer, and then the manufacturer was making the car seats and then supplying them to Autokit, in those circumstances, the supply of the fabric for free should also be included in the calculations. So what then happened was some fairly protracted correspondence and visits between HMRC and Autokit. So in April 2012, there was a penalty letter, rather unfortunately. saying that where previous demands, C18s, had been issued and had been paid, there had nonetheless been a failure to correct for earlier periods, and so there was a penalty and then a warning for future two future years. In respect of which it was said that if AutoKit failed to do things correctly, then they were going to get themselves into more trouble penalty-wise. In June 2013, it turned out they were still using the wrong codes. So a further C18 demand was issued and it was paid. Then in July, another penalty that was issued and paid. And on it went, until eventually, in April 2016, HMRC issued a notice which said that this was conduct involving dishonesty. And this is where things got a little bit more complicated. So what had happened in the interim was that the taxpayer had taken a few steps. So, for example, they changed the country of their supplier. They had, in one of the meetings with HMRC, said, well, can you come and audit us quarterly and check that we're doing things right? And HMRC also in that period checked with DHL whether the taxpayer had actually been in touch with DHL to say, well, sort out the codes, right, etc. In the event, a penalty was issued, which was 80% of the duty. There were two little reductions of 10% each for disclosure and cooperation. And the question that went to the tribunal was an appeal about whether or not the penalty was properly issued. The case is interesting because it applies, it's not the first application of this case, but it is a sort of more detailed application of the Ivy and Genting case from the Supreme Court from 2017 on what constitutes dishonesty. Yeah,
absolutely.
So we have seen it in other cases, but as I say, this is quite a detailed application of it. And of course, just by way of reminder for those who aren't perhaps dealing with dishonesty day to day, so the test in Ivy and Genting is that what you have to do is ascertain the subjective standard, as in what the person thought and believed at the time, and then you must assess by the ordinary standards of decent people whether or not that conduct would have been regarded as dishonest. So the fact that somebody doesn't think that they were dishonest is not enough to get them off the hook anymore.
Yeah.
So it is an interesting case. Here, the tribunal actually found that this chap was, he had a what's called a simple lack of diligence. And they found that actually that was carelessness rather than dishonesty. One of the things that was quite interesting, though, was that they also noted that HMRC could have gone for a lesser penalty here. They could have gone for a penalty which applied to each C18, which wouldn't have required them to demonstrate dishonesty. So in a dishonesty case, the burden of proof is on the revenue and it's on the balance of probabilities. And administratively, it must have been easier to issue one penalty which covered everything. Lesser penalty which didn't require dishonesty would have required them to do one for each of the C18s. And the tribunal was somewhat critical of the approach of the revenue in that particular context. So
it's an interesting one. I've seen in, not in relation to customs duty, but even in terms of VAT, where it's occasions where sort of financial directors or tax directors are trying to be completely helpful to HMRC and clarifying a factual position, and will say something, not so much without thinking, but they'll just say something immediately just to try and be helpful. If a week goes by, a month goes by, and further questions are asked or something else comes to mind which actually changes what was said previously, we've had it where officers of HMRC have said, oh, well, now I'll have to treat that as you were dishonest the first time, which was the furthest thing from those people's minds. It was just a way to be helpful to the revenue. But I suppose the overarching point is you've always got to be careful with what you say. If you're not 100% sure and have evidence for something, do not just spit something out. Take advice on it and clarify the position. You get no awards for being quick with something, but better to be correct than be quick. Because otherwise, not to say that this was the case here, but I have seen elsewhere where people are trying to backtrack, and nobody wants to be in the tribunal for any tax case, understood, but least of all for one involving any sort of allegations of dishonesty.
Absolutely.
So one to keep in mind, definitely.
Yeah. One of the interesting things they said in this case was that because the taxpayer had alleged that there were some genuine technical disputes, They did note that the taxpayer was perhaps not quite as quick as he could have been to resolve those technical issues, but they did point out that where you've got that sort of factual matrix, that might be around diligence and carelessness. It doesn't necessarily amount to dishonesty. If the taxpayer genuinely believed that there was a technical dispute to be had, then that's a very different position to a dishonesty one. It wouldn't surprise me if there are lots more cases of this variety testing the limits of what actually amounts to carelessness and what's dishonesty in this context.
In different elements of indirect tax, not just customs duty.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. Do you have any further thoughts or comments?
None from me. I thought that was very insightful as ever.
You always are welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So this webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2 to maintain competence and legal knowledge, and A4, which draws on detailed knowledge and understanding of the SRA's statement of solicitor competence. You can also use the quiz, which can be accessed on the Take a Quiz link on the webinar details page to reinforce your understanding of the webinar content. You should answer 7 out of 10 of the questions correctly, and you will have 2 attempts at the quiz. So please submit any feedback you have via the survey screen. And the webinar is going to be archived immediately and will be available on demand for 24 months. We can watch ourselves for 2 years.
How lovely.
And a transcript of the webinar is going to be made available on request. Thank you very much for joining us today. Hope you found it interesting.
Thank you.